web services. And last time, the they were originally developed, the major technologies were basically SOAP, WSDL, and UDDI. And SOAP, even if there's the term simple object access protocol in it, it's therefore it still takes some time to basically develop the SOAP interface, and people try to look for something easier and something which is easier to handle, and they basically then come up using the REST interface. And the point is here, the REST, that stands for representational state transfer, and it's actually not a standard protocol. It's basically just an architectural style. And if you look as a not a standard in a sense of protocol, and it's more like, well, the way how you use and you interact with a web service. And the web itself is considered a REST system in a sense of that you can think of it that you can contact the web server with a web page. It's the web page is sent back to the client, and then basically a state transfer occurs because of the client looking at the or interpreting the web page. And that's basically behind the whole thing. And when you look at it here, the approach that you interact using just a regular ID, an URI, and that identifies a resource. And that resource, that's any item you're interested in it. It can be a document, a collection of items. It can be a virtual or physical objects or computational results. Therefore, it can be any item of interest. And you know how an URL looks. You have on the front, you have here the web address to find it, and then basically the information about the resource. And here you can have a hierarchy until you get to the resource. And here we have a representation of the resource. Therefore, in that sense, Boeing 747 HTML, that's basically would be something like a description of the airplane. That's a representation of it. You send that representation back. It's in the HTML format, and that would cause the application to get in a new state. You can link things, and using just the links between between items, between documents. And the most important things is that you use standard methods in the sense of get, post, put, delete. And that's the major difference what you have compared with SOAP. In SOAP, you define an application-specific interface. You define the methods or the functions, and then you have it available using them. Basically, for example, the WSDL file, you describe the operations and so on. Here, you use just the standard methods, what you know from any web browser and web server. And the advantage of the whole thing is if you use that type of methods, and if a resource accepts the REST style of interface, you don't really have to ask what kind of methods are you supporting. Basically, you already know that's the methods what it supports. Therefore, it's a given, and That's what I mean here with architectural style, that you define, that's the methods what are used, and that's are the methods we already use from web browsing and web servers. The communication is stateless, and in that sense, in order to give to keep state, you have to use cookies. That's, you know, from web pages. And otherwise, it does not really, the server or the resource does not keep any state. And the resources have, you can have accept multiple formats. And usually when you send back what kind of representations are accepted, if it's text or if it's another type of thing, as we already know from web pages where you send the possible formats back with a request. And if we look at it, the major thing is this here. Every resource has basically the same interface. And if we look at how many systems use REST and how many systems use SOAP, we can say in 2004, that's where I have the data because that's where they collected, about 80% of the web services basically used REST, and the remaining 20% used SOAP. And to using the REST interface, it's just much faster to implement and provide a web service which accepts REST style interface. The so much for that, and there's you just use regular HTTP to transfer the data. Another important aspect of web services is the composition. And the point is also where a company which wants to decide to move into a service-oriented environment and basically decide what kind of granularity do they support with respect to the services. And you have the possibility to say, well, I have very small services, but then I would have thousands of it. And on the other hand, you can also take the approach and say, well, we have just large services and more or less just a handful web services, and possibly look at your business processes and see what kind of functionality these business processes have, and then divide it up into some sub-pieces, but then you might end up with 50, 60, or 70 web services. And the other one, you end up with thousands. If you have thousands of it, you have the possibility to reuse them in very different contexts, but it makes it a lot more difficult to search for the appropriate web service. And very often companies are not really certain, do they want to take this approach with small services or do they take the approach with very large services? And some companies go in that direction, some companies go rather in the other direction. And it really depends how much they want to propagate and actively reuse available web services. And the reuse of web services also allows you to build new web services. Like, for example, here you have a travel agency, and that travel agency uses other web services, like for hotel, for airline reservation, or for rental car. And you could even think of, well, for a hotel, you don't just use one, you use many depending if every hotel has one, or you book it via booking.com or whatever, or Hotel Horace or whatever. And therefore, in that sense, there can be a whole bunch of different web services used by a larger a composite web service. The dimensions which have to be looked at with respect to composition, certainly it's the component model, and there here, as I already mentioned, it's the granularity for reuse, and larger web services are more difficult to reuse. Smaller ones are easier to integrate in a new context. The other thing is also, how do you divide it up? I mean, do you take a look at your business process and divide it up into components, or do you take the approach what Korba originally did? They said, well, we have application-specific components, and then we have some basic components like a transaction component, like a persistence component, which does persistent storage. Therefore, in that sense, you have something like application-independent basic services which can be used in any context. And that's somewhat a decision how to build up your component model. The orchestration model, that defines how the subservices basically are interact with or are invoked. And certainly you need something like, I can say, something like a workflow language. And what kind of ways do you have to basically model the interaction? That can be certainly, you can use Petrinets to check and say, well, nodes are web services and transitions basically fire to go from one web service to the other one. And that's for coordination. You can have something like activity diagrams and describe here the interaction between the subservices. You can also use state charts, or you can also define something like rule-based orchestration. Also here, rule-based orchestration. And for people who know about artificial intelligence, there it's more or less you define rules, and if certain events occur, then out of the rules, it's checked which rules are applicable, and then the rule, either the first rule you find, which is applicable, is basically applied, and that would mean in our case then this specific or attached subservice is invoked. And it can be also, if multiple rules are applicable, then a random one is selected. And therefore you have a whole bunch of possibilities to specify how the workflow of the between the subservices basically occur. And you have here with the web service standards, the web service coordination. It's web service coordination, that's a framework, and how the different web services, and in our case the subservices interact with each other. And it also provides something like activation. If a web service is not active, it activates them. It has a coordination between web services, how that is done, or the registration service. Basically here, a web service registers with the coordinator and says, well, I'm available for to taking over certain certain tasks. Even if we have an orchestration model or a composite web services, the web services are still pretty autonomous. And that's the goal of it. They're somewhat a self-contained entity which have a well-defined interface. And therefore, this is not lost here. And therefore, you need something like a coordination component or a coordination service which basically coordinates the interaction between the different web services. Here, the data access model specifies the data exchange between the, that means the data flow between the sub-services, and certainly data you have on one hand, the application data, and on the other hand, you have something like control data or control flow data. So here, control flow data. And it could mean here that, for example, one subservice sends to the next subservice together with the application data also something like the schedule. Who comes next? And in the sense, when this one gets, when this, the second subservice gets the data, it performs the task, and then it looks at the schedule, the control flow, and then sends the result to the third subservice, together also with the schedule. And therefore, in that sense, control flow is also exchanged between the sub, these subservices. And you have the possibility with the data exchange, you can do it explicit. And explicit means you have messages going explicitly from one subservice to the other subservice, or you can do it implicit. And implicit, that would be something like a blackboard approach. And blackboard means that one subservice posts the result on a board or in a shared information space, a second subservice comes and takes it out. And that's very often this type of interaction is quite often done when you have something like a rule-based interaction between the subservices. Because there, the posting of data triggers an event. And that event might trigger another subservice if it waits for that event, and then it can take the data out of the shared information space. The next thing is transactional model. Also, when you do a composition, you look like it. Do you handle something like transactional semantics? In a way, if when we had before this travel agency, when we said we have the subservice hotel, airplane, car, and there we can combine it to all or nothing bundling, because if you you need a hotel, you need a plane ride, you need a car in order to be successful in booking it. And if you don't get a hotel, then basically also you don't want a plane ride and you don't want to have a car reservation. Therefore, in that sense, you can have the subservices, bundle them into a single transaction and then have these all or nothing behavior, this atomic behavior. And with the transaction, you can have two different types for the coordination type. You have something what we call these atomic transactions. This is the all or nothing, and you can use two-phase commit. And it's, we can say, short time, also here, short time usage. And therefore, it's a rather short-lived transaction. But then you have also this business activity, and that's something like long-lived activities. And long-lived, I mean here, that goes over days, weeks, and possibly even months. And therefore, you can't use this standard approach, what you know from atomic transactions, where you say, well, you put things into a single transaction, and then after you finished your 10 requests, then you try to commit or you have to abort. Therefore, in that sense, it has a completely different behavior. For example, in resource allocation, with atomic transactions here, resources are allocated for a rather limited time. Here, resources are usually allocated possibly for long times. And you have to find ways how to interact with. And also possibly here is how do you handle exceptions? How do you handle intermediate results? Do you handle intermediate results during the business activity? And therefore, in that sense, you have a completely different way of interacting between the sub-services. The exception handling, that's the last thing from the model. Well, how do you handle errors in sub-services? Certainly, if you put them under transactional model, then if one sub-service fails, then you can abort the whole sub-services which run under the transactional model. That makes it then a very easy way to handle errors. The if we look at the orchestration variations which are available, and one of the things is you have these three different types, and here we have a brief description on it. And we could basically look at the pictures here: transparent chaining, translucent chaining, and opaque chaining. Transparent chaining, that's in a way that you say you have a UDDI registry. The client interacts with the registry, and basically decides from the client side then how to invoke the web services. And therefore, in that sense, on one hand, the client decides how to invoke the web services, and therefore, on the other hand, the client is always aware what web service should be invoked next. And therefore, in that sense, the web service is completely aware of the whole workflow. If we have translucent chaining, the interaction here is the client interacts with a workflow service, and the workflow service now invokes the individual web services depending on its schedule, which it maintains here. And these web services would basically just return status information. Like now the web service 1 is called, now the web service 2 is called, and so on. And then finally the result, well, either the last web service sends back the results, or the results go back via the workflow service. The point is here, if you, for example, think of government offices or sometimes on large institutions, if you sent a request for something there, and then they would send you always an update. Now this department looks at it. And then a few days later, you get another update. Well, the department 2 looks now at it. And then possibly a few days later, the department 3 sends you an update and says, well, we received your request and now we are looking at it. Therefore, in that sense, you don't really know what the workflow is. You just get always updates that something is happening. And the client is not really aware how the chain looks at the beginning. He can derive it always from the updates it gets. And one place, or one step further, the opaque service. Therefore, in that sense, you have here aggregate service. You invoke it. This one invokes the web services in the order it decides. The web services exchange the data among, and then the final result go back to the aggregate service and then go back to the client. In that sense here, the client does not really know how many subservices are really involved. It only knows that it gets a result. It doesn't even know it's an aggregate service. It just knows this is a service. And therefore, in that sense, it completely eliminates the client's awareness. But it gives the freedom for the provider that it can subdivide it in any way the provider wants to. The next thing is adopting web services. And there are a number of web services available. And an example is the Amazon e-commerce service, ECS. And that basically provides a number of information. And it's, on one hand, it's also used, for example, by third-party sellers, that they can actually use the interface, the web service interface. And what do you get from the type of data? What do you have? Product information, customer contributed content, seller information, because it provides third-party sellers, then also third-party product information, and you also your shopping cart, what do you have there. And what it provides, you can integrate the Amazon Web Service into your own environment and then possibly look at or use functions like item search, look for a specific item according to keywords, similarity lookup. In a sense, it checks your provider ID and then it looks up the attributes of the product ID, and then it looks for similar ones. And here you can also have the access to a specific product. You have also functions for the shopping cart of the client. You can create one, add items, but also you have possibility of get the content, modify items, or clear the whole shopping cart. And if you have a REST style, I mean, Amazon Web Service provide SOAP interface as well as a REST interface. And if you look at a REST interface here, that's web services. It provides you want to have the commerce service. You have an access key. You need some kind of an authorization. to use it, to register, and then you have here the operation, item search, and then here the index, and then the keywords, what you look for example, for books, that you look in a book domain. And it makes it rather easy to integrate that into your own, for example, web page or web service. And it's not really in the sense that you have to do a lot of Java programming. It's basically a few liner what you add to your environment and you use. And then certainly you need then some kind of an interpretation to basically parse the result and work with it. The other things what I want to mention, adopting, if you use Apache Access, it provides the support of web services, and what it has, it has a sequence of handlers. In a sense, if a SOAP message is received, then it's basically piped into a sequence of handlers. Also here, SOAP messages. Also here, SOAP message. And then it's go through a sequence of handlers. Each handler does some very specific functionality, and each handler basically supports one specific interface, and that's basically the interface here. Also here, interface. That's here the invoke. And then you have the message context. So here, message context, which is basically the message what you support. And that's supported by every handler. And therefore, in that sense, what you have is here, you have, that's what you have with the client-side API to invoke SOAP web services. They can have a WSDL description or not. Then also what Apache provides is to translate WSDL documents into Java frameworks. Then also a way how to host them using, for example, within a servlet container. And then it provides a whole bunch of other functions which might be useful to handle SOAP messages, like manipulate a SOAP envelope, like interpreting SOAP bodies, headers, and so on, and also the message content. And also it provides here ways to map of Java classes into the appropriate XML schema. Access already supported it. Now we have Access 2. It has a more flexible approach, and now it also supports RESTful support of web services. And therefore, in that sense, it's a pretty easy way to extend or to use Apache for web service usage. The last thing is that's just a list of Java APIs for providing and manipulating objects or WSDL or XML. And here I listed just some of them. And to say that, I mean, that's not something like what we ask in the exam or things like that. But it's only just for you to give you a hint that you have a whole bunch of possibilities when you do Java programming, that for Java services, that you have already a number of library functions which you can use to handle and manipulate parts of web services. The another important aspect what I wanted to mention here is the distributed architecture, and therefore in that sense web services are basically the mechanism and the way to integrate legacy software into the whole environment. And legacy software, well, it was programmed in some old language like COBOL or things like that. And now what they have to build is something like an adapter to make it accessible from the network. And then they built on top a web service or multiple web services, which basically can now be used by clients in the company, and thus in the intranet, to interact with all kinds of applications, even with applications which were not originally intended for the intranet. And they do not require to be newly implemented. If you, with this adapter, with web services, you have a full accessibility, and therefore here occurs then the mapping towards the legacy application. Or here you go a mapping to the RMI objects environment. RMI applications are somewhat tightly integrated application. Web services, we mentioned, that's a loosely integrated computing environment. And here you might also, instead of RMI, you can also have CORBA, and then you can come down to the CORBA services and also other application services to come to enterprise data. And that's the trend, that legacy applications still continue to exist, and you have a pretty well-defined migration path into a service-oriented infrastructure within the company or organization. The one thing what I wanted to mention, there was already a while ago, the intention to have something like semantic web services. And one of the things is that we have something like automatic discovery. Currently, so here, currently often manual discovery by this developer. And what the developer goes to a registry of web services, a UDDI registry or like X methods, checks the description and decides, well, that fits. And that's I will integrate into my computational environment. And what the goal of semantic web services is, that this is done automatically. The application searches for it and interprets the WSDL description. And there's also the question, is the WSDL description sufficient? And the other part of it is the automatic interaction and chaining and incorporation. And an approach to the whole thing was, is this web service ontologies, and like here, OWL, and the ontology web language, and there exists multiple variations of it, 1, 2, 3, and 3 is the most complex one, which basically provides you the most possibilities with deriving intelligence. But on the other hand, it's rather difficult to implement web services which conform to the free standard. And why we would need it? For example, if we look at the approach that we say, well, we'll look for a map web service, and input are XY values. I mean, these are XY values. And what we want to get back is, for example, an output, a map. And, well, it can be PNG or JPEG or GIF. Well, it depends. But the problem now is, with a web service, if we don't have any additional semantic description, how to interpret the input? So here, how to interpret. Is XY in the center of the map? Is it in the corner of the map? Is which corner left bottom or left top? Or on the right, what coordinate system do we use? WGS 84 or Gauss-Krüger? There exists a whole bunch of ways of coordinate systems. And these type of things have to be described in the meta information in the for the web service description. And if we look at a web service description language, well, we have here data formats, the data types. We have here the messages going back and forth, the parameters of the messages. We have the operations associated with messages, using these messages. We have the binding information like protocol, HTTP, or whatever. We have the network address. But, well, we have a description of the data type, but not really how to interpret components of our parameters. And therefore, we would need some kind of a description of it, of the input. The same thing is with the output. It's not really described in the current WSDL file. And what kind of map do you want? Do you want a topological map, political, points of interest, traffic map? If you look at Google Maps, well, you as a user decide what kind of map you want. And therefore, in that sense, you switch between the different modi. And also, what kind of measuring you want to have. And OWL is a possibility to have here the way an ontology which provides additional meta information. And here is an ontology variant, especially for web services. That's this OWL-S, and that allows you to automate web service tasks. So here, automate web service tasks. Because otherwise, if you need some kind of interpretation, then and interpretation, if a human is involved, then you can't really completely automate it. You can possibly only half automate it or quarter automate it, because the user still has to work with. And that also that refers to discovery, execution, composition. Also here, discovery, execution, composition. The next thing we can look at in the context of web services are these mashups. And I assume that most of you know iframes. Does anybody not know what iframes are? And I mean, that was the early way to combine things. And you selected parts of your web page and said, well, here's an iframe, there's an iframe, and here you have a third iframe. And that was basically, each iframe was then got the data from one web page, and they were put together into a combined representation. The point of it was basically each iframe was something for itself. It you defined only the placement where it was done, but there was not really any interaction between the iframes. That is, well, the iframe changed the data depending what the other iframe currently presents an information. Therefore, there was not really an interaction. And you didn't mash up data from different things. And if you, for example, if you had a search, if you had a search and you had an iframe for one search engine, then an iframe from second search engine, and then for a third. And therefore, in that sense, the results were basically completely separated. And with mashups, what you can do now is you can put it together, get one representation, and the data come from all the different sources, and then they put together and possibly reordered, reprioritized, and so on. And therefore, you don't really possibly immediately see where they actually come from. And that's the goal of mashups. And here, the point is here, the mashup is a way of creating new web applications by combining existing web resources. And the point is here that you have quite different ways of realizing or implementing the whole mashup. And you can think of it, one differentiation happens in the sense of where does the mashup take place. Is it done on the server? And therefore the server looks up all the different parts, puts them together, and then generates a final result, and the client looks at the final result. Or you do the mashup on the client side. The client interacts with all the different servers, retrieves the data, mixes it up, and then presenting it to the client. And possibly you can use with Ajax in the sense of as the data come, you update it. Or you do a combination of both of them. And we can look at the different approaches now, like meshing up on a web server. Here, it's a way to the client. You do a GET, then you have a mashup web server. It does here a SOAP request to like Amazon, gets a SOAP response, then it knows Yahoo has a REST interface, it interacts with that, gets it back, mixes it up, and then it sends the result back to the client. And the aggregation here may mean mixing up the results here. And that's a good approach if, so here, good approach if client capabilities are unknown. And therefore, in that sense, well, you can access it using a workstation from the client side. You can access it using a smartphone. And the point of it that you don't really have a computational effort here on the client side. Therefore, you can possibly use a smartphone. All the computation and meshing up is done on the server side. And especially useful, also here useful for mobile devices. For mobile client devices. The other thing is the characteristics, it's decoupled. The browser acts as a proxy. But the problem what you have is a scalability problem. For example, if you have here an interesting web service, a lot of people discover it because it's posted somewhere in Facebook or wherever. And then you have a huge number of people and say, well, that's a cool now portal or a mashup web server. And then you might have a scalability problem because here the mashup server might be overloaded and really can't handle the huge number of requests. And therefore, you could go the other way and use here where you do most of the computation on the client side. And the client side here is, again, you do go to the mashup server, but then you get something like, as a response, you download some JavaScript functions. I mean, you get from the mashup server, you get some JavaScript functions. Then you send an HX request, and then you get the interaction here from the mashup web server to Amazon to the REST API from Yahoo. Then, therefore, in that sense, it acts as a proxy, and then here it might combine certain things, and then a lot of transformation is done here on the client side. And as part of the JavaScript, it's also something like display functions. And these display functions then prepare things, and here they prepare the page content. And because you use Ajax, the update or the interaction is done asynchronously. And in that sense, the your web page is modified continuously depending what kind of results come in from your mashup server. And certainly you could think, well, why don't you just download your JavaScripts and then you interact with Amazon, with the different web servers. That might not be possible due to security reasons, because usually when you download from one something, you can't really go to anywhere else and download other things from other sites. And therefore, in that sense, if you download first from here, from the MeshUp web server, you can't really go here and here and here because of the built-in security what you have in the HTTP request objects. And that's the way how you go via the web server as a proxy here. And the advantage certainly is this web server, that MeshUp web server, does not have to do so much, because a lot of the functionality you moved into the browser environment. The disadvantage is if you have a very poor computation environment, then it might be a problem to display things. And the other thing is also you have a problem when you use IHEX, the navigation mechanism is bypassed. And if you know with a web page or web browser, you have the history, you go back. Well, if you use HX, go back means you go back somewhere else as you think you go back. And because all the, through the update, that's basically bypassed. The, what else do I have here? And well, the presentation is driven by XSLT, that means style sheets, and you could even possibly have special style sheets in your environment. And that's what I already mentioned. It's rooted through a common point on the server due to security reasons. The other things you could, instead of using Ajax, you could also use JSON. And JSON stands for JavaScript notation, object notation. And it's not really restricted for a use with MeshUp, in a MeshUp sense. You could also work with it in a completely different way for exchanging between applications instead of using XML. And what JSON has, so here JSON, I write it now here, it's basically name value pairs. Did anybody use that already for programming? Okay. The one thing is it's name value pairs, and you can think of it that you say, and it's also hierarchical. And for example, you could say, well, I have an album, and that consists of here the title, and then you have some kind of song title. Then you have here the artist. And here you have the singer or the band and X, Y, Z, and then you basically close it. And that's here somewhat a transfer of information. And that's a way also you can describe like a Java object. You describe here and also specify JavaScript objects. I mean, you have here the attributes of the JavaScript objects, the name, and then the value. And here a hierarchy of name-value pairs. And that's here what happens here. You have the same thing as you interact with the Meshup web server. You download a number of scripts. And for example, here you have a parsing script. And now here you can create a new script, like a display script. And then you can interact with your partners, get a JSON object back. You parse the JSON object and then convert it into XHTML and then display it. And with the new script here, the script that's basically you download the display function, and then the display function then processes here the result of what you receive here as a result from the Meshup partner. Here I have only one. You could also certainly have multiple ones. And you have here then what you need, a script for presentation and a script for parsing. So here, parsing and presentation to parse the JSON object. Then let's think here. You download here basically the script here, what comes back. And that's now interpreted. The advantage is it communicates directly, and JSON objects are somewhat easier than XML. It's less verbose because you see here you have just the name and the values, and in XML you have all the tags associated with it. And when you have the tags, you have the beginning tag, you have the end tag. And also the server is not really involved, but the problem is the user environment has to be pretty powerful to handle all that scripts and execute them. The last thing is there exists development support for developing mashups. And two things again, as we saw with web services again. One of it is the component model and the composition model. Component model, what are the components? Like the mashup components, and you can say, well, the type of component, is it a data component? Does it just provide data, or is it an application logic? It does some computation, or a user interface? It does some user interface preparation. And usually it supports the interface create, read, update, delete, as you know it, as a rather generic interaction. And you have to decide, do you allow the user to add new things, or is it pretty fixed? Like, for example, very often a portal in a company, it's realized as a mashup environment. And there you can decide, does an individual employee is allowed to add new measure pieces to its environment, or is it something like fixed for the company provided? And the composition model, how you glue the mashup, glue the components together, is it more flow-based, a sequencing between the components, or is it event-based with publish and subscribe? And the point is not so much that the individual user triggers the individual mashup components. It's more like you trigger, for example, like a search. And you could say you can then use multiple databases to search with. And for example, let's say search for a book of a person who wrote on a certain on a certain topic, and that person lived for 5 years in Munich, and is there an author who lived then for several years in Munich? And what you need is something like a search in a library database, but then you also have to search in a person database where there is something like the CV in it, and where you find out, well, that first you search for a person who lived there. You have to map it between the author of the book and the person database, and then you can combine it. And then, for example, if you change in your search certain aspects, like, for example, well, now I want to know if the person lived in Prague, then it might change the search in a database, person database, but also it meant how the search in the book database is done. And therefore, in that sense, you certainly have an interaction. And in a way, you have to trigger it in a flow-based, well, do you search first in a book database and then you search in the person database, like searching for people who lived for a while in Prague and who are authors. And, well, it depends really where you get less results just to reduce the interaction between the components. There exists tool-based development, for example, Yahoo Pipes. There you can have mashup components, and then you just pipe it through these mashup components. And the other things what I have listed here, you can look as a Yahoo Pipes is one from IBM. There's a wiki-based mashup maker with QED Wiki. And if you want to look at mashups like programmable web, that's a directory. And there you can look at a whole bunch of mashups and see how they are put together, how they are developed, and what kind of service they provide. Therefore, in that sense, mashups are composite web services. And because they combine things together. The next thing what I want to quickly provide is the design of distributed applications. And one of the things that's now a whole bunch of lists. I mean, that's not something like what you have to write down by heart. And it's more like an orientation for you if you decide to write a distributed application, to look it up and see, well, what kind of issues are of interest when I wanted to, while I develop my distributed application. Certainly, some of it, what is my software structure? How do I decompose it? What is locally? What is remotely? And the other really important aspect, how do I want to test it and debug it? And there I have to consider the whole network delay and also handle something like intermittent or transient failures. And these transient failures often caused by some delay in the network, then there's nothing really wrong, but then your timing in the software components are possibly set not correctly, or they don't handle long delay. They handle short delay, but not long delay. The other things, well, how do you do name resolution to localize like services? And how do you assign names? And what do you do if a client cannot connect to a localized subservice? Is there something like an alternative? Also here, alternative. And that would mean go to the registry, look by category for a new alternative, and try to contact that. How is the communication mechanism? Here, certainly, client-server, peer-to-peer, group communication. And how do we handle network errors? The other things to look at, consistency. One of the things, how do you keep replicated data consistent? And here we will look at like voting approaches in the context of file systems. And also, well, cache. It's used for improvement. It would mean, do you have a client maintained or a server maintained cache? If it's a client maintained cache, the client has to update it, and therefore it has to contact the server and ask, well, did something change? That's what you have very often with proxy servers. They go to the web server and ask, well, is it still up to date? And otherwise it's invalidated. If a server maintained cache, if something changes, the server sends an invalidation message to the client, to the cache. User interface consistency, well, for multi-user editing. If two or three people work with the same document, how do they update it? And if one changes it, the notification or the update should be propagated to all sites. The last thing what we have here is user requirements, reconfigurability, then quality, security, reliability, fault tolerance. What kind of security mechanisms do you want to have? Well, if you have a distributed environment, Do you have something like an authentication at all different sites, or do you have something like open authentication service, which basically is an individual entity or component, and which provides you then the token to get an authentication for all involved servers you want to contact with. And tier heterogeneity and efficiency. I mean, these are all kinds of issues which you have to look at or think of it when you develop a distributed application. And some of, or most of them, we actually already covered. Some of them we will cover, like with these replicated data. The steps to design, that's very quick to look at it. Application data, identify them, assign them to the repositories, or also assign them to the modules. And for example, if you do Photoshop type of thing or graphics, well, you want to have the data near the modules which do the processing. Define the interface, network interface, modules, and then registration, and then a strategy. And therefore, with a binding, is it a static binding or a dynamic binding? Therefore, in that sense, it's rather straightforward. The one thing what I quickly want to go through is here the steps. And certainly you have your, when you do software development, you have something like a software development cycle. And the point is now, well, if you do software development, requirements analysis, specification, design, implementation, test, integration, maintenance. And that's the thing what you hear also in software engineering courses, like what Breuer, Brügge do, or also Brechner and Mattes. And one of the very interesting approaches was done by these open distributed processing that did not really come out of software engineering. It came out of the experience with developing network protocols. And for all the people of you who were in a network course, you know the ISO/OSI reference model, or the alternative is the TCP/IP internet protocol stack. And the point is here that with the open distributed processing, they wanted to define a reference model for distributed applications. It was a nice idea, but it was not really very successful. The only thing which is actually left over of the whole effort of open distributed processing is this different levels of abstractions of distributed systems. And it provides something like a handle. What kind of viewpoints do I have when I develop a distributed application? The top most viewpoint would be the enterprise viewpoint. Here, you deal with the overall goals the distributed system should achieve within the organization. You look at the interaction between the application and the organization, and the focus is more on the benefit of the organization as a whole. As we hear, benefit of organization as a whole. And it's in that sense, it's more like a business process view. Also here, business process. You don't really look at technology. The next thing would be more like the information view, structure, control, and access of information. And there, it's also more like, well, who has access, when, and what part of it. Computation viewpoint, that's more like logical distribution of data in the whole network. And engineering viewpoint is here the physical distribution. And it's what kind of subsystems do you have? What kind of physical distribution do you have? And here, technology, that deals with technical subsystems, like hardware platform, network. And the point is here, in the distributed development, you should look at all different viewpoints. And it's a rather bad approach to start here and go up here. Then possibly it's a mismatch and nobody uses your distributed application. It's very often, it's more in a direction you go here from the enterprise viewpoint, or the other thing is what happens sometimes, the approach, what you have. Oh, sorry, that's not such a good color. It's going, you start from the computation viewpoints or the information viewpoint, you go up here and you go down here. That means it's you start somewhere in the middle. And the advantage of these viewpoints is that you don't really forget certain things. And for example, if you look at a typical example of a distributed application, like a calendar reservation and or like a time schedule or appointment scheduling system. Appointment scheduling system is inherently distributed application because every individual person has a calendar. That calendar is updated by the individual person, and where it enters its appointments and free time and so on. And if you, for example, as a team leader, say, well, I would like to have a meeting because of that, a project meeting, you trigger your application, the calendar application, and now it should check what is the best time to find a meeting time. And what it means, it would go into all the different calendars of the individual people and derive when they are free, and then come up with a joint appointment, and then reserve that and schedule then that meeting because everybody has now time. The point is here, well, if you forgot to look at the information viewpoint, possibly you don't like to have an application going into your calendar. You possibly have an entrance, well, on that work day, during work, I want to go to the dentist. You don't really enter it as an appointment because usually in a business calendar you enter not your private appointments. You enter business appointments. You possibly block it out, that type. Well, it's blocked out without any additional information. Therefore, your boss comes back, well, why can't we have the meeting at that time? According to the things, you blocked it out, but you didn't specify that you have anything important to do. And therefore, in that sense, there's completely the information viewpoint missing. And therefore, in that sense, the calendar system is not really used by the people because they avoid it. And because it does not handle all the different aspects of the people involved. And that's the goal of the different viewpoints, that you try to look at the perspective at or from different viewpoints, and not just, well, how do I implement it, but also how users work with. The last thing I want to quickly mention, that MDA, that's actually this model-driven approach, which is comes from software engineering. I just want to mention it here, and it has nothing specific about distributed application. The MDA concept is you have a model describing your application, and you have a language which basically describes your model. And if you look at the MDA concept, model-driven architecture, you start out with a platform-independent model, your business function. You have here a platform-specific model, specifics about the platform where it runs, where your application runs off on. And then you have code generation and system test. And when you look at the different steps, like the PIMs, PSMs, and then code generation. PIM, here you can use UML, use case diagrams, class diagrams, sequence diagrams, state charts, and you hide completely what kind of technology you use. Do you use SOAP? Do you use REST? And you would only provide like pre and post conditions. And the next step, you already have specific up your platform. Like, do you have a web service model? Do you have an enterprise Java Bean model? A CORBA model? And therefore, in that sense here, these models is a realization of the software solution in UML. Therefore, in that sense, you have a transfer to already the specifics of the platform. And the last thing is you basically map it now into constructs, Java constructs or C++ constructs. And the goal is here an automatic code generation completely from the platform-independent model to the code generation. And if somebody is interested in it, I mean, here, what I mentioned here, this autofocus that's developed in the group from Professor Proy here, and there are a number of thesis work available, and it also provides an requirement analysis tools, it provides modeling tools, and it also provides code generation. And also interactive simulation environment. In a sense, you generate code, simulate it, and see how it interacts with, and basically try to use it as a development. And the important things why I mention it here, it also has functionality in it to develop a distributed applications. And therefore, in that sense, it's not just for single user, single environment application. It also provides support for distributed applications. And if somebody is interested, they can actually look at it. And if you want to be interested in it, work with it, then you could check if they have thesis available there. Okay, then thanks very much.